stuff, and I've spent the whole morning talking about the program. I do it every Sunday morning. I get to talk every Sunday morning, and I noticed there's one person in this room I know that was there, but I gave them a sermon on the first three steps this morning. They didn't know that. That's what they got. And it's good for them. It's good for them. They're at least as sick, if not sicker, than we are, so that's all right. And then I taught a class in between, and I was off of page 86 in the book, the bottom part, in 86 and 87. And that was good, and they liked that, so that's... I pass out on a regular basis the third step prayer. I call it a prayer of decision. They think it's wonderful. And I give them the seventh step prayer, and it's just wonderful. And so I think normal people have a right to some spirituality, too. And so I do my best to try and help them out with that. And I kid about that, but I'm really not kidding. I'm really not kidding. I am so grateful to God that... that what you have given me, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart, what you have given to me, I can never, ever, ever repay you for. There was a guy that was a roommate of mine. In fact, there were a couple of people when I was in the Ark, and I'll tell you part of that story, but these are thoughts that have gone through my mind as I was sitting here waiting and listening to that third chapter, and geez, Nina, that was a riot when you read it. I did all those things. I did a couple of others. I used to take Alka-Seltzer before I went out. I really thought that was what you should do and things of that nature, and I switched from bourbon to scotch and all that. And I did all those things, and I thought about that, and the first times I heard it, and I remember this guy was in treatment with me. I can't remember his first name, so I can't really name him. I know his last name, but anyhow... He was up here in Clovis, and we used to always talk about how they were thinking about putting a treatment center up here. And Clovis was very resistant to putting a treatment center up here because they didn't have any problem. And his remark always used to be, my God, they got enough alcohol up there, they could float the Ark, you know, I mean. And here you are. We were right. I mean, so it's great. I'm really glad to be here. One of the things that is a bit of a problem, every time I get introduced, I cringe a little bit when I get introduced as Father Bernie, because I remember there's a guy by the name of Hilary Draper, who was the abbot of St. Bernard's Monastery. He was a Benedictine monk, and he was the abbot of the monastery, and one time he got up, and he had a beautiful Alabama accent, just gorgeous. Oh, it was really... I won't begin to try and imitate it because it was so real and so good. And he got out and said, my name is Father Hilary, and I'm an alcoholic. And he had an old hard-shelled Baptist sponsor. And he called him over and said, Hilary, come over here a minute. He said, Hilary, the next time you get up to talk, you get up and say, my name is Bernie, my name is Hilary, and I'm a drunk, and sit down and shut up. And my sponsor kind of agreed on that, And what you have given me, and you're going to see why you gave it to me, what you have given me is the ability that today, because I can say to you, my name is Bernie and I'm an alcoholic, and because God gave me this sobriety, and because you let me be with you, and you let me be one of you, and you gave me this book to read that I just think is the most spiritual book I have ever read in my life. I literally put this book on the same par as I do the scripture. I believe it's as truly inspired by God as anything else in this world. I believe it, and who else but God could write? Certainly not those 100 drunks, that's for sure. It's just gorgeous. And I've been given that, and because of you and because of the books and because of the steps, when I go out today and somebody says to me, hi, Father, I'm not embarrassed. But the... Madonna, my wife, has a car, and on the car she always wanted, and we got for our vanity plate, and it just says to Madonna on it. And I'm not afraid to drive that today, and I'm not afraid to let anybody see it. But I remember years ago when somebody offered to buy me a vanity plate, you know, when I was in Oklahoma and in Chicago, I wouldn't put them on my car for nothing. I didn't want anybody to know where I was or what I was doing or what was happening. Now I can let you say that, and I don't have to be embarrassed about it. Well, my first sponsor, told me that what I was supposed to do when I was privileged to be able to come to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and share with you, that I was supposed to do three things. And he said, and don't let me ever, ever, ever hear you say that you're going to tell them what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. He said, don't you ever dare do that. And I said, why? I thought that's what I was supposed to do. He said, no, you don't. He says, you tell them what you were like, what happened to you, and what you're like now. He said, that's the only thing you have, is you have your experience and strength and hope to share. Not it, but you. And that's why I think sometimes it's a little bit difficult for us. I can talk all morning, give lectures on alcoholism. It doesn't bother me at all. But when I get here with you, I got to tell you who I really am. I got to tell you who I am and what I did. And when I tell them to you, I don't say I'm proud of it, but I think what happens when I get to share that, I remember what a miracle I am. I'm a real miracle. Look around the room. We're all real miracles. You don't have to go to Lourdes. You don't have to go overseas to some miracle place. This is it, friends. This is it. We're real miracles, and I mean that in the strict sense of the word. Let me start out and tell you where I was born, what happened to me, and all that stuff. I was born in Chicago, Illinois, on the south side of Chicago. I was born into a fine Christian family. And from the number of people I hear born in fine Christian families that end up in AA, I'm not too sure it's a good place to start out, but that's the way it is. That's where I started, and that's who I am. I want to make it very, very clear from the beginning, because I hear so much of the psychological baloney today about this disease of ours. I am not an alcoholic because my mama put me on the potty backwards or anything that my mother and father did. I am an alcoholic because I'm an alcoholic. I drank. I drank just the right amount for just the right length of time until God said, time. And when God said time, I got a chance to come in and be with you, and that's how I got sober. But I loved my mother and father dearly. I don't blame them. I have absolutely no blame for them whatsoever. My dad was an alcoholic. He died an alcoholic. My dad was periodic. My mother should have been the founder of Al-Anon. She just never joined. My father was periodic, and what happened, my mother would give my father that look. She sort of set her jaw and gave him that look. And if my mother gave you that look, you'd all be periodic, too. It was just, that's the way it was. And I love them both, but they had this disease full-blown. I had an uncle who was a priest. He was an alcoholic. He died an alcoholic. We never used to talk about it. He always used to get in one car accidents at 3 o'clock in the morning or something like that, you know. And in those days, nobody would talk about this. You couldn't. And I had another uncle who was a bookie who I believe is an alcoholic. He died, too, and I'm pretty sure he died an alcoholic. And we just didn't talk about it. You didn't do that. It was just, you know, all you had to really learn to do, and I understood this, and I believed it with all my heart and soul. It's one of my biggest problems. It's just say your prayers and use your willpower. And I knew that was it. Drink like a man. Use your willpower. And I just believed that. And so I used to get very angry in those days with my dad. First of all, I got angry because he allowed my mother to control him. And then I got angry with her for controlling him. And it seemed like weakness. Just say your prayers and use your willpower, and you can do anything you want to do, and that's what I decided. And I made up my mind I would not be like my dad. Because I looked at my dad as being weak. Why can't you drink like a man, for God's sake? Oh, I used to feel strongly about that. Am I doing something wrong? Okay. I've done that before, too, so I didn't, you know. Right. So anyhow, I used to really... I really got upset because I couldn't understand why I couldn't drink like a man, and I looked at it in a weakness, and because of that weakness, I had a hard time with that. I thought I loved him, but I didn't love him nearly as enough as I do now and find out that the poor guy was an alcoholic. Well, anyhow, I was one of those kids around school that you would absolutely detest. I love school. I just love school. I love to study, and I loved to, and I was given a pretty decent mind, so I always did my homework, and I was one of those kids, you know, I went to parochial school. The sister would say, well, somebody clean the backboard. I'd always put my hand up. I was always bringing cookies if they needed that, doing my homework, always... I always wanted to do things, and the reason why, when I first got sober and was trying to do my steps and things like that, for the first 3 years, almost the first 3 years, I think, not maybe quite that long, maybe only 2 years, that I was sober, I thought that my major character defect is I thought I was better than you. You know what I mean? I thought that that's what's wrong with me. You think you're better than everybody, and as a result, that's why your life turned out to be such. I wasn't it at all. I heard a guy talk one time, and it dawned on me. What really was the problem is I never thought I was as good as you. I never thought I was as good. So I was always, always, always trying to do things that would make me fit in, that would make you like me. And that's why I was doing all that stuff all the time. And so I would pick out things to do that I thought were hard and that maybe you didn't want to do. There weren't many of you went off to the seminary to be priests. I said, I think I'll be one of them. It's a terrible thing to admit, but that kind of was part of it. Today it's a lot different, but part of it was, you'll see me do that and you'll say, isn't he wonderful? And then I'd go do that. And I didn't hear many of you. I used to hear people talk about chemistry and how difficult it was. And when I was a little kid, my folks got me a little Gilbert chemistry set, and I played with it down in the basement. I make things go boom, or the smell bad, and so there's a little bird down the basement with his chemistry site. And you paid attention. I decided I'll be a research chemist, and I did that. And everything I decided to do, everything I did it so you'd pat me on the head and tell me, that's great, you pay attention. I made up my mind I'd do all those things. I made up my mind I'd play football. I didn't play baseball or basketball because I was a fat little kid. I remember the first time I went to play basketball, I ran on the court, fell down, and rolled over a couple of times. Never going to play that anymore. Didn't play baseball. But football and hockey, the two sports I love, all you do is hit people, you know. Just get in there, and they put me right in the center of the line, you know, and I filled up a big hole. And then I could be there and play. And I just loved football, and I loved hockey, because you could do those things. And I won when I did that. So I did that. Baseball, basketball, you had to have some finesse. I wasn't very good at that. So I wouldn't do things I couldn't win at because I wanted you to like me. I wanted to fit in. And I always wanted that. And I began to do things because I had a pretty decent mind, and I began to study, and I began to find out, it was amazing later, I found out if you study, you get good grades. I didn't know that. But as I did all those things, I began to do the stuff, and the next thing you know, I started to get successful at what I did. And everything I did worked. Everything I did seemed to work. So I started to take credit for it. Now, I would know how to mound it. I would always say, oh, I'm doing very well, but God is helping me, you know. You know, oh, I knew who was doing the work, you know. But the fact of the matter is I began to take credit for it, and I never, ever, ever said thank you is what began to happen. And I would take credit for this, I would do this, and it would work, and I'd take credit for it, and everything that happened. Well, I wanted to learn how to fly an airplane. So I got a license, and first day I got my license, I went over to Midway Airport, which at the time was the busiest airport in the world, landed over there, got my radio license, because I wanted people to see me and say, look at that crazy priest, he's flying that airplane. And you'd see me, and you do all this stuff. And I ended up manipulating, I was ordained at the time a Roman Catholic priest, and I really, really, really wanted to be a good priest. And I came back to Chicago, I manipulated that, so they sent me there. And typical, what an awful thing to happen to an alcoholic. The first year I started teaching, I was the only one with a master's degree in chemistry, so they put me in charge. I was head of the science department the first year, and I had 15 teachers working for me, you know. God, that just goes to an alcoholic's head like, man, I was going to graduate school out of Loyola and downtown to DePaul, and I just like, every time I hear Clancy say this, it comes right to my mind. I hit that ground going about 100 miles an hour, and I lasted 50 yards, you know. Just boom. And I was teaching all day long. I was running around, and then we'd go out at night and drink. We'd come home. I'd teach all day long. I'd go downtown or go up to Loyola. Then I'd come home, and then we'd go out and we'd drink. We never said we were going out to drink. We said we were going out to have a steak sandwich. That was always what we said. And about six or seven Manhattans later, you know, we'd try to find the way home. And all this kind of stuff was going on. Well, one day I was flying my airplane, landed in a pea patch, and they got upset with me, and they shipped me off to Oklahoma. I lost an engine over the all-night show road. Was in the paper and all that. They weren't very happy about that. So they shipped me off to Oklahoma, and everybody thought, oh, how terrible, you're being shipped down to Oklahoma. That's awful. Well, they sent me to Tulsa. God, I love Tulsa. It's a beautiful, beautiful town. You know what day I got to Tulsa? I can remember the exact day. You know why? It was September 1st, 1959. You know why that day is so important? That's the day Oklahoma went wet. That's the day I got there. And it was just really something else. And I loved Oklahoma, and I loved Tulsa in particular. It was a beautiful city, but what I found out, and now this is not really true, but everybody just drank like a fish. They all drank more than I did, and I just loved it. And they'd carry their booze around in a brown paper bag because you couldn't buy it by the drink. And, well, if you went out for dinner and you had a quart of bourbon or a quart of scotch with you, obviously you're not going to be seen walking out of a restaurant with a brown paper bag, so you drink the whole thing, you know. It was just that way, and I didn't understand. And this thought crosses my mind every time I tell this story. I see their faces. There was a gal there that was just the mother of one of my kids was just a gorgeous gal. She looked like a twin sister of Barbara Stanwyck. She died 53 years old from alcoholism. I have another friend of mine. His name was Bob, and I have a very vivid picture of him in my mind. I used to play golf with him and stuff, and he's handcuffed to the steering wheel of a police car. This is on television, and he's sitting there and laughing like a fool. And in front of him was a little foreign car, I forget what it was, that had been rear-ended by him, and it burst into flame, and he killed the guy in there. And he's sitting there laughing at him, didn't know any better, because he was drunk out of his mind. I have another real good friend of mine who died of a brain tumor, a young fella. Presidents of oil companies and things like that, and they died. They died from this disease, and I'm still here, and I can't... I know that I'm no better than them, no better than any of them, but somehow or other God set time, and I got to get sober. And it really makes me grateful to be here and to understand that and to know what it's all about. And that my dear friends, so many of them died in Tulsa. But that's where I really, you know, went into some of my drinking spree, because I went down there and I was kind of free and on my own. And I made up my mind I'd be headmaster of that school. I loved it. Oh, God, I loved it. I loved Tulsa. And I loved teaching, and I loved to be with my kids. And I used to ride all over the darn Southwest with them. And I loved football, and I would go out and I would take my teams out with him, and I'd stand on the sidelines with him, and I'd ride on the buses, and I was in the locker rooms and the shower rooms with him, and just loved these kids. But I couldn't quit drinking. I just didn't know what it was all about. I remember one night I was driving down a street called Peoria in Tulsa, and it's kind of like, I don't know if this went out here, Clovis Avenue, but sort of a main drag where people drive. And I'm out there, and all of a sudden I look up, and the guys with those funny cars, you know, they have those crazy lights on them, came up behind me, and I pulled over, and I said to him, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" And he said, "Oh, for God's sake, you're all over the damn street." And I was not dumb. I always signed my license Father Flynn, you know. So he said, "Let me see your license." And I whipped him out to him, and he said, "Oh, for God's sake, Father, go on home." The police in Chicago in particular, where I started, they love us to death. I remember I was talking with Pam, Don Simpson. He made that remark one time. He said, I shouldn't have said his last name, but that's all right. He didn't care. He said, you know, the police loved us to death, and that's about the truth of it. They loved us to death, and we didn't know any better. And anyhow, this guy looked at my license, and he said, "Oh, for God's sake, go on home, Father." And they wouldn't dare let me drive my car home, and they took my car and parked it across the street. They put me in a cab and sent me home. Do you think I was grateful when I got home? No, I went upstairs, got the set of keys to another car, and went back out again. Just insane behavior. Well, I kept going and going down there, and I became headmaster of the school, and I was doing all those things. I lived in Tulsa for about 12 years, and maybe 12 to 14 years, and I loved it. I came back to Chicago for a little while and became a fundraiser and flew all over the crazy country and meeting with all these people and drinking all the time. And my disease is getting worse all the time. It's getting worse. And what I would do is go on a diet or something like that for Lent, and I would tell people, you know, I never looked forward to Easter was the trouble. I looked over to the beef eater martini and when Easter was coming, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And I tell people that I'm quitting drinking so I can prove I can control my drinking. There's two stories that I think are really important. When I first started drinking in Chicago, and I forgot to tell you these, and they're very important. I quit when I got there because my father was alcoholic, my two uncles were alcoholics, and because of that, I made up my mind this would not happen to me. I doubt if any of you identify with that, but you remember, I will not let this happen to me. I'm going to use my willpower. So I quit drinking the first year I got to Chicago. I quit drinking to prove I could control my drinking before I started drinking. That's the chemical waiting, you know, the disease waiting for the chemical to catch up. Well, at the end of that first year, it was in May, I went over to Westgate Country Club playing golf with a friend of mine, and we finished the front nine and went into the bar, and the bartender said to my friend, "Well, do you want?" And he ordered something. I think he got a beer. The guy looked at me and he said, "What do you want?" And I had said I'd quit for a year, but that was 9 months. It was a school year, so that was good enough. So I proved I was better than you, so I said, "Well, let me see," and I didn't know what to get, and sign was up there, Miller's, the champagne and bottle beer, you gotta look good. So I said, "I'll have one of them." I had two or three of them. I used to think I had one. I had two or three of them, or some number of them. Went back out to the 10th tee, and the first time in my life, I drove the green. And my friend says to me, gee, you did pretty good with that bear, Bernie. And I said, yeah. 2 days later, I went over to Midway Airport to pick up a friend of mine that was flying in from Detroit, and we were going to lunch. There was a little Italian restaurant across the street, Cavallini's, and we went in there, and this little gal comes around, and they're so accommodating. She said, what can I get you? And she was going around asking everybody, you know, and I thought that was real nice of her. And she was asking Armin, and she asked the guy next to me here, when I get you, and he said he'd have a Manhattan. I said, I never had one of them. I think I'll try that. Well, I had that, and oh, my God, was it good. Oh, it just went down so warm and sweet and wonderful, and I just loved it. Well, I must have had two or three of those, too, because on the way home back to my room where I was staying at the school, I got very tired driving. I don't think I slept well the night before. But on the way home, I stopped in the liquor store, and I went in, and the guy said to me, what do you want? I don't know, I said, but there it is, there. Give me that Seagram 7 Crown. I thought that sounded sophisticated. I didn't know any better. Try to drink like a gentleman. You remember how you used to try and do that? I mean, at one point in our... You know, I just wanted to go to the party. I just wanted to be with you. I didn't want to get drunk. I just wanted to be with you. What I wanted to do was fit in and feel okay about myself. So I said, I'll have a bottle of that Seagram 7 Crown, because they had told me the way you make these Manhattan is two shots of bourbon and one shot of vermouth, you know. So I didn't know any better. So I got this bottle of bourbon, and then he said, and I said, that little red wine that you make those Manhattans. Said, oh, here, and he gave me a little bottle of vermouth. And I went home to my room, and I got a great big snifter out. It was about this big. And I put a tray of ice cubes in it. I mean, it was really a big one. I put this tray of ice cubes in it, and then I got a water glass, and it said 2-1, so I poured two of those out, and put them in there. Then I poured one of vermouth. I never heard of a dry Manhattan, you know. Poured that in there, swirled it around, and that night I drank the whole fifth of bourbon. And God, it was good. I loved it. I just loved it. Now, I can't dance. I don't know how to dance. But that night, I could have made Fred Astaire look like a piker. I was... I'm not very good looking, but I'm telling you, Robert Redford, get out of the way. Here I come. It just did something for me that was just... And I loved it. I loved it. And then I used to say I went to sleep. I know what I did. I passed out. That from that day on, I did something, too, that I began to do regularly, and that's I lied a lot about how I felt. Because remember I told you that I hated my dad's problem, that he would drink and be... And I was mad at him because he was weak. I saw that as a sign of weakness to get drunk and let my mother tell him what to do. So when anybody would say to me, do you have a hangover? I'd say, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. And I remember just before I got sober, Madonna would say to me, how do you feel this morning? And I wanted to say, tell the fly to stop it, you know. And I would say, just fine, just fine. Nothing wrong with me. I just could not face the reality. Well, I was down in Oklahoma. I was lying about who I was. I was telling everybody I was very happy. And I wasn't. I loved my kids. I loved the work I was doing. I loved to teach. I loved to run my school. And it was really great fun. But I did not want to be a celibate priest. I just did not want to. I could not figure out spending. And I knew, I don't know where I got, I think, you know, we think that once we get sober, God takes over. God's doing this thing all along, all along. We're just sort of going along for the ride. You know, we're drunk. We don't even know what's happening to us. He's bringing us along. We must have because we got here. And so anyhow, I didn't want to end up being a cheater. I just didn't want to do that. And I didn't want to end up being an old, disgruntled, angry old person, too. So I went to see my superiors, and I talked to a psychologist at the University of Tulsa and told him everything was going on, and I left the order. And I went up to Chicago, and I married this little girl. I was waiting until she got old enough to get married, and married Madonna, and we ended up in Madison, Wisconsin, a little town, Middleton, but we first started in Madison, Wisconsin. And next thing I know, I was principal. And talk about, you know, there I was. I walked away from a job, and the next thing you know, I got another one. I was principal of a big public high school. I had a real nice house I was living in, and God sent us a blessing. Well, you know, I say God sent us a blessing. Some of my friends said, are you sure? We had two teenage daughters. We adopted two teenage daughters the first year we were married. We went to our first wedding anniversary dinner and had our two teenage daughters with us and everything. It was just... It was really something else, I'll tell you. It's really exciting. And there we are, and I'm living there in the house with these three women. Jeez, what a... you know, I mean, but it's a miracle anybody gets sober. But anyhow, I didn't get sober then. So, anyhow, there I am living there, and I'm running this school, and I'm doing all this. I forgot to quit drinking. And I went for 3.5 years there, and, you know, and I used to say it was their fault, but what it really, I used to say, you know, well, I don't belong in a fault. I had my orders validated. I was back at the altar. I was celebrating Mass again, and I went to this little Episcopal church, beautiful church on the hill overlooking Lake Mendota, Monona, and I had everything. And I couldn't quit drinking. And so one day somebody asked me if I wanted to come down to Kenosha and go back full-time into the ministry and be this guy's assistant. And Madonna got a job teaching at a school down there, and we lived right on Lake Michigan. It was just gorgeous. 3 tennis courts and then our house right looking at Lake Michigan, the campus of the school. And I was this guy's assistant and in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And now I'm full-time back in the church, and that's what was wrong. I should have been there all the... Well... A man of my talent shouldn't be anybody's assistant. So, of course, you drank a little. You know how that goes. The guy in the book, the guy that used to own the automobile store and ended up being the salesman, and he, of course he got drunk. And so I went there for a year, and then I finally got it. And this is going on. There's a lot of crap going on all through this, you know. And then I got a phone call and asked me if I wanted to go down to Versailles, Kentucky. And that's the way they say it. That's not my fault. It's Versailles, but they say it Versailles, Kentucky. And it's a little town in central bluegrass country, just gorgeous where all the racehorses are, and just beautiful. And it's the home of the mint julep. Oh, dear God, what a dream for an alcoholic. A mint julep, they drink it in a silver glass, so you can't see what's in there, but... And it's an alcoholic's dream, because what you get to do is, it's very respectable to drink mint juleps, you see. So you can come into somebody's house and say, would you like a drink? And I can say, oh, I'd love a mint julep. Would you like a mint julep? Kentucky Derby time? Oh, God, they just live for it. And, you know, and you come in, would you like something? And yes, it is. And they get this silver glass out. And all you do is you put some brown sugar in, the real one now. This, I got a little book on this thing. Just a little brown sugar on the bottom, and then you put the mint and you mess it up with a spoon like that. Then you put a tablespoon full of water in there, and literally measure it out, don't put too much in. And then you fill it with crushed ice, and then just fill it up with pure bourbon. Just pure bourbon. And then you pretend to smell it, you know, and then, you know, and, oh, God, it's wonderful. Well, I got there. Very conservative area, very conservative. On the street where I lived, I had this beautiful, beautiful home on Elm Street, just beautiful. Over here, right over here, I remember Happy Chandler, the ex-governor of Kentucky, the boy wonder, and the chairman, the guy was commissioner of baseball, and all that kind of stuff. He lives over here, college professors around me. Oh, God, it's quiet and conservative. Then you got this drunken priest living on the street. It was really something else. And so anyhow, I remember one night I came home there, and I finally have my own parish now and all this, and I'm in Kentucky, and now I'm back in charge and all this stuff. So one night I was out and we came home and I had my daughter with me and somebody, one of my daughters with me and her fiance, I guess, or something like that. And I came home. This is how bad it got. I was so drunk. This house had this lovely big porch on it. It's very, very quiet. Big, huge trees, gorgeous. Little yellow light that shined down and the, you know, very honest, big glass doors. The front doors were made out of glass, you know, and you didn't need anything else, and swings. And I came up to the door and come roaring in the car and got out. I was so drunk I couldn't get the key in the door, and I peed my pants all over the place, you know, right there, standing there. That's how I acted. Another time, they were going to have a wedding, and my daughter was going to get married, and they had a party for them, and it was going to be all church people, so Madonna would say to me, now, Byrne, take it easy, take it easy, take it easy. And I would. The way you take it easy, I found out, the way you do this is I had the julep cup, you see, And so nobody can see what's in it. So they're about 12 ounces. They're a good sized glass. I would fill it up with ice, and then I would pour all this bourbon. I'd fill it up with bourbon. And then I bought a thing that was like the ladies use for perfume, an aspirator. Well, I bought one of those. I found it in a magazine somewhere, I guess put out by some alcoholic. And it was an aspirator to distribute vermouth. So I'd fill this up with bourbon. Shoot the vermouth at it like that. Now I'm respectable, you see, because I'm drinking a Manhattan. If you don't do that, you're having a glass of whiskey. You can't go to their house and say, can I fix you a drink? Yeah, I'll have a glass of whiskey. No, I mean, you don't say that. But you can say you're having a Manhattan. Dry. Just that much vermouth. Well, I'd have 2 of those, you see. Quick. Boom, boom. Now I'm ready to go to the party and take it easy. And then you get to the party. Can I fix you a drink, Father? Oh, yes, I thought you never asked. No, And then they give you this tall glass like this. They put that much bourbon in it, ice, and that much water, and say, here, enjoy yourself. How? You know, it's just... Gee, it's just terrible. And then you sit there and you mother a couple of those, you know, for the evening. It was just awful. And then finally, you know, well, at this party, what happened? I got there, and they give me this, and I'm sitting there. Oh, I'm having a wonderful time, thank you. And all this. Well, then most of them left, you know, and there was a couple of my drinking buddies left around. And I went for it. Well, I decided to go home. Now, Madonna says that isn't quite the way it happened. She said they decided I should go home. And it was supposedly, I'm sure it must have rained a lot and gotten very slippery. Because on the way to the car, I fell down several times, and it's the only thing I can figure out. But anyhow, we got in the car, we were going to drive home, and Madonna couldn't find her way out of the housing development that we were in. So I quietly got out of the car and said, here, dear, let me help you. Now, she says that I got out ranting and raving and screaming, but I doubt if I ever did that. And I must have fallen on a few times getting from one side of the car to the other. And I drove home. Now, it's a miracle we got home because in Kentucky, the roads never run straight for more than 30 feet. They're always curving. They're always going up and down. And they have stone fences on both sides and great big trees. And so, and now I kind of remember leaving. I kind of remember that. The next thing I remember, because this was on Saturday night, is I woke up fully clothed in bed. And I jumped out of bed at 8:10, I remember, and I was fully clothed, and I ran in the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and the wrath of God was looking right back at me. I mean, there was no lens in this glass here. My face is covered with blood and dirt. And anytime I think I'm getting well, this is a little reminder God gives me. If I ever think I'm getting well, I just feel this right here. There's a little scar right there that this thing jammed into my face. I was a mess. My eyes, it was a nightmare on Elm Street. It was just terrible, just awful. And there I was. Well, I ran back in the bedroom and bawled Madonna out for allowing that to happen. It was her fault. Should have never allowed that to happen. Then I got very alcoholic. I went right back in the bathroom. I washed my face with all my alcoholic dignity. I put on my glasses, no lens in here. And I proceeded to go over to church and tell them on the way out, I tripped and fell off the top stairs and jumped and fell and locked on here. And, you know, and they knew. You know that part in the book? It says, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. God, it was awful. If it weren't for this program, I could never go back to Kentucky. I'll tell you. Well, that just kept going on, and finally one day, those Southerners, they didn't understand me. And it was a little town. I should have a bigger church. And it, you know, and I got a phone call. And this lady says, my name's so-and-so, and I'm from Fresno, California. And I said, where's that? And she told me, I didn't know what it was or where it was. And anyhow, they brought me on an airplane and brought me out here to talk to them. And there it was, you know, there's Fresno, California. And, well, now this is just a little bit more like it. Now I got this real lovely parish in fine northwest Fresno. And this was 15 years ago when it was really the cat's meow and all that, you know. And, geez, and... Well, this is it. This is it. And you know what you people in California do? I know what it is. You just have a little white wine. That's all you need. Right? Well, I tried that for about a week. That doesn't work. And so anyhow, I got here in April 1st, 1979, and I was pretty well along the line that I didn't do any outside heavy drinking or anything like that. You know, we were pretty good at covering up. We could just come home and drink and stuff like that, and I did that, and I had another young priest that was behind me and worked for me. I had about 5 or 6 of them working for me out there, and so this young guy came out to California, and he went to a little place down in Southern California, not in Southern California, the southern part of the valley, and one of the little towns, I'm not going to tell you which one, and I got out here, and he hadn't drank for 18 years. He wouldn't go to AA, hadn't drank for 18 years, and so finally, when he got out here, he was ordained priest. And, everybody knows, you know, if you're ordained a priest, you can drink like a gentleman. So he decided to try it again after 18 years. And oh, God, it was a mess. And so the bishop had to send somebody down to help him. Guess who they sent? Goofy here. I went down. Now, there isn't anybody in this room that doesn't know that prayer works. You can't be in this program and sober if you don't think the 11-step works. I mean, it does. It works. And anyhow, I went. So I'm not making fun of praying, all right? But I went down there and I bawled him out and I said, "You drink like a gentleman now and shake that off." And I laid hands on him and, oh, dear God, it was awful. Then I went home and had a couple of drinks because it was just terrible. I mean, it was awful how hard it was. Anyhow, I got home and I kept going on and on and on and on and on and on. And finally, the bishop sent in a registration. I got a little thing ministering to the alcoholic. I threw that in the wastebasket. I knew how to take care of them. The bishop didn't know I was an expert on alcoholism. And so he sent another young guy that came out here from Kentucky with me, and we went to a seminar put on by Fresno Community Hospital called Ministering to the Alcoholic. And so I went down to it. I tell you, I walked in that day, and I was scared to death. I was afraid they're going to catch me. And I didn't know what they were going to catch me doing, but I heard about this thing called the disease. And I found out that there were people who had a disease. Now, my problem was I heard that there were some people who just drank and got drunk and that was wrong. Then there were other people who had this disease. And they drank the way they drank because that's what they were. They were alcoholics. Well, I sure as hell knew I wasn't one of them, so I had to be somebody who was a sinner that was drinking too much or something like that. It was really insane the way I was. Thought the seminar was good. I saw a lot of things they did, and I went home late in October sometime, I remember one night I said to Madonna, "You know, I got to do something about this drinking. I really got to do something about this drinking." And she said, "Well, you're not an alcoholic, are you?" I said, "Oh, God, no. I knew what you had to do if you were an alcoholic. You had to go to that A&A thing, and I was not about to do that. So I just made sure, no. But I was going to do something about it. Well, that was in late October, November. Well, I thought, what I'll do is get it under control. I'll quit for a couple of days. I could do that anytime. Quit for a couple of days. So, well, you can't quit for Christmas. That's not even Christian, for God's sake. And then New Year's was coming, and you can't. That's no good. And then the Super Bowl was going to be at the end of January, and so I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to get my drinking under control the day after the Super Bowl. Now, the day of the Super Bowl, I had a big, big Super Bowl party. I had one every year. I've had one ever since. I had one from the first one in 1967 right up to the present. In fact, we almost got called by the police once after we had all quit drinking because we made so much noise. But anyhow, I went to the Super Bowl party, and I just sat there and kept drinking my little bourbon and water, and nobody bothered me. And I went to work the next day and came home. I remember this as clear as a bell. I got up in the morning. Today's the day, I'm going to quit drinking. Today's the day. And I went off to work, and I came home that night, and I walked in the front door. I remember walking in, turning the corner. I reached up over the sink and got down the julep cup. I popped in the ice. I reached up, got the bourbon, poured it in, and said, I'll quit tomorrow. I'll never forget that. Went over to my office that night. I came home from my office. I put the key in the front door, opened the front door, and there's the house, and just the living room was full of people. Weren't full. There was maybe six or seven people. Here was Father Mazak and his wife. There was over there. There was a bald-headed fat guy, I remember, sitting over here in the corner. There was another couple from the parish right here. And, oh, there's Madonna. Oh, thank God she's there. Nobody's hurt. Because when I walked in that front door, they were very serious. They were not laughing, and it was 9 o'clock at night. I didn't know what was happening. So I walked in, and I don't know what they're doing. I said, "Hi." But I don't know what this fat, bald-headed fat guy's doing over here in the corner. I said, "I know you from someplace." And he got up out of the chair and started to walk at me, and he said, "My name's Ashley Dick, and I'm from Fresno Community Hospital." I said, "Oh, my God, you're here for me. I knew what they were going to do. Just right now. I've seen this thing, this intervention, and what they do is really rotten. They write down all the rotten things you've ever done, you know. They write them down, and then they tell you about it and all that." So my little alcoholic mind goes to work right away, and they say, "Oh," Madonna said to me, "Oh, honey, do you know how sick you are?" Yeah. And so, and Mazak says over here in the corner, and he says, "Brian, we love you so much, we went to see the bishop about your drinking." Thanks a hell of a lot. God, you know, friends like that, who needs enemies? So they said, "Do you know how sick you are?" I said, Yeah, I do. I know what they did. They tell you all these rotten things, see, and then you're supposed to realize. So when I went to show them as how well I was, I would tell them the most rotten thing that I knew they knew I did. I wasn't going to tell them everything. But I'm going to tell them the most rotten thing I knew they knew I did. So just before we came to California, they gave a going-away party for us up in Chicago. We drove up from Kentucky to Chicago and had a going-away party. Madonna says it was a thank God they're going party, but I thought it was a going-away party. And I was in charge of the booze, and it was downstairs in Chicago. The family rooms are downstairs. They have a bar and a pool table or a think-tank table, and, you know, and that's where the dens are. And so we did that, and we hung around. And I, you know, had those watered-down drinks or a couple of beers or something like that, just a pain in the neck. And then finally everybody started to leave, and I went for it. And I really went for it. And the next thing I remember now, they tell me this is about 2 o'clock in the morning or 2:30 in the morning. My brother-in-law is behind the bar, and he's saying, "What the hell are you doing?" And I'm behind, I'm over here peeing on a chair. I thought I was in the bathroom. Oh, God. That's what I was like. So I told him that, you see. I told him, "Yeah, I know, I know, I know." And I said, yeah. And so I knew what they were doing, you know. Well, if you don't get help, you're going to lose your parish. Oh, hell, I get another parish. You know how alcoholics are. If you won't do this, we can't be your friend anymore. I don't like you anyhow. But the problem was that over here was Madonna. And once before, when my daughter got married in 1978, she said, "Bernie, I love you so much that if I thought I didn't help you to quit drinking, I'd leave you." And I took her home and got her drunk. But this time, somehow, I knew she meant it. I really knew she meant it. And I love that girl more than anything else in the world. I love her with my whole heart and soul. And I knew she was going to say to me that, "Bernie, if you don't get help, you got to go." And I knew she meant it. And I didn't know what to do. I just sat down and I said, "Tell me about it." I said, "Tell me about it." They had my suitcase passed. I was in the car and gone. But that's the way to do it. And I remember getting down to the yard. It was down on Fresno Street downtown. And I walked down. They had a big sign over the front door: "Abandon all hope, all ye who enter here." I mean, I remember that. You know, it was a mile and a half long, the sidewalk. I had to walk up by myself. And I walked in there that night, I will never forget, and God, you were a bunch of sick-looking people. Oh, God, I was well bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and you were all so sick. And I didn't belong there, you know, and all that kind of thing. But I remember they put a pair of pajamas on me, and they put those god-awful blue pajamas on, you know, no back in here. Put little things on your feet so you got to shuffle and keep mine. And I don't know what keeps me sober. Those blue pajamas are my higher power, really. Just out of our... Put me in there. They put me on the bed. They put you on a plastic-covered mattress. You know why it's plastic. It's when you wet the bed, you won't ruin the mattress. I mean, and I knew, and the light's on outside, and the guy over here just threw up, and the other guy's snoring, you know. And then they said, "Have a good sleep." And I laid on that bed, and it all was coming true, and I said, "Look what you have done with your life. Look what you have done." And then I remember, I said what every single person in this room has said. Every single one of us has done this, and it's the best, it saved our lives. The words that I use, you may have used slightly different words, but every one of us has said the same word. I said, "God, help me to learn to live without this chemical." That's the way I said it. I was a chemist, so I thought of it as a chemical. I don't know why I did, but I did. But really, basically, what I said is, "Help. I can't do it. I can't do it. Help me. Help me. Help me." Now, you might say, "Oh, well, you were a priest, Hal. You believed in God. That was easy." Let me tell you a little secret. If you have been treated real, real good, if you have been given everything, a good education and a good mind, I'm afraid to death you'd ever find out how much I drank. I was afraid you'd find out what I did when I drank. I was afraid that if you ever got to know me, you wouldn't like me. And then I was frightened, if you didn't like me, you certainly couldn't love me and wouldn't love me, and I desperately wanted you to love me. I still to this day want people to love me. But I was afraid to death to tell anybody. I was afraid something awful was going to happen. You know how that is? I'd come home from a vacation, just getting ready to turn the corner to see my house, and I wonder if a bomb fell on it, or that impending doom thing that book talks about. And then I was afraid, and I'd say, "Bernie, what are you afraid of?" And I'd say, "I don't know. I don't know." Just that. I know now the book tells me I had a lot of nameless fears that were just there all the time. And you know what the worst fear I had of all? I could never tell anybody I was afraid. Did you ever go into a bar and walk up to a guy and say, "Will you talk to me? I'm so afraid." Boom! But I can come in here and I can tell you that. I can sit down at anybody next to anybody in this room and say, "I'm so frightened today. I don't know what's going on, man." And they'll say, "Yeah, tell me about it. I know." And we can do it. That's one of the great things about this. And I think you go from fear to faith. You go to that trust level. It's going to work. The fear is that first step, and I think it's given to me. I didn't take a course in it. I've been through the seminar. I heard all about it. Hell, I thought it was wonderful. I wrote a critique on that seminar and sent it in to him. I thought it was the finest thing in the world for you people. I just thought it was... I never saw it for me. I didn't figure this out. I believe that first step is given to you. It was for me. It was just delivered on the front door. I used to say when I sat down in that little yellow chair that I had, that I didn't know what happened. I know what happened. I think that's when God said, "Time." I feel like, if I was the quarterback doing a quarterback sneak and there's only 3 seconds left and the whole damn team's piled on top of me and I reach up and look up and say, "Time. Time." It was time for me to get sober. The miracle of my sobriety that I'll never understand, when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask God first thing, "How'd you pull this sucker off?" It's not surprising to me that our higher power gives us this gift of sobriety. That's not the key that's surprising to me. Because you and I all know there's a whole bunch of people that are every bit as good or better than I am. Well, they're not better than me and not any worse than me, but they're every bit as good, that are out there still dying from our disease. And Chuck C. told my wife one time, he said, "The miracle is not that we got sober like we're special." He said, "God gives this to everybody. The miracle is how come we accepted it?" And that's what I don't understand. How come I said yes? I'll never figure that one out. And yet, I only said yes because he gave it to me. And then somehow or other, I came to believe it. When I was, I got sober on the 21st of January in 1980. And on the 8th of February, they shipped us over to the Alano Club to go to a meeting. I say ship because I didn't want to go to none of these things. I mean, I got taken to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not say, "I don't think I'm going to go to Hawaii this week. I think I'll go to AA." No, nothing like that. They shipped me over to the Alano Club, and I heard a story that said, if you stick around long enough, you'll hear your story. Well, this is the 8th of February, and guess what they had? They had a recovered alcoholic priest there. Jeez, I almost died. I listened, holy crap, And he told my story. He told about all the things he did and all the stuff, and he told about how it came to that second step. He knew he had to work these steps. He knew he had to have a spiritual awakening. He knew he had to work the steps, and he didn't quite know how to do that second step. And he didn't understand what spirituality was, and I know I didn't, because my sponsor and I talked about that. I remember my sponsor, he knows, some of you old-timers that are here may have known my sponsor, Ed H. He was 23 and a half years sober when I got sober. And he told me one time he picked up a priest in front of St. John's downtown. And he said, the guy was drunk as a skunk, a young kid. And he said, "Now, Father, don't you worry about this." He said, "You just got to admit you can't do it and that God can do it, and then give your life to God and it'll be okay." And he said, "Don't you tell me about that's spirituality. I went to Rome and studied and I did this and I did that, and don't you talk to me about spiritual stuff. I know more about spiritual stuff than you do." And my sponsor said to him, "Oh, Father, I know you know more about spiritual things than I do. But if you know so much about spirituality, how come you're drunk and I'm sober?" And he told me that story. And I heard it. And I know who he was telling it to, too. And so I remember that. And I knew I didn't know about this. And I listened to John Haley was the guy's name, who's from Southern California. He was 8 years sober at the time. And I listened to him. And he said to him that God sent him a sponsor. And I just love this about AA. I just love it about it. He doesn't send you who you think. He doesn't send you who you expect. He throws us together. I've got friends all over the place, all over the country, that I would have never met if it weren't for you. And so he sent John. John was a recovered Roman Catholic priest. And he sent John a hard shell Baptist. And the two of them got together, and there they go. Boy. And he went up to his sponsor and he said, "I think you're trying to get me to give up my religion." He said, "No, John, I'm not trying to get you to give up your religion." He said, but what I hear you tell me is your religion sounds to me like you got more John in it than you do God. He said, John, do you really want to work this second step? And I'm really listening. And he said, I want you to do this, and it's the hardest thing I have ever done in my life, and I do it every day, still do to this day. He said, I want you to take every single preconceived notion you've ever had about a God, every single preconceived notion you've ever had about a God. If you're a good little girl, God will love you. If you're a good little girl, God will love you. But if you don't, he's going to grab you by the big toe and fry you like a Frito, you know. All that kind of junk. He said, take every one of those preconceived notions you've ever had about a God and give it back. Now, that was really scary for me to do. It was really scary. I didn't know what to do. But I wanted to do this so bad. And John said so he did it. He took all the confusion and all the guilt and all the shame and all the do's and don'ts and all this stuff. And he trusted and he gave it back. He said, then you ask. And he said, this is where the trust comes in. Then you ask. Now, God, you tell me who you want me to think you are. You tell me. And so I did that. And I've never had a bit of trouble again with a loving God. And when I said to you, when I get to heaven, I'm going to go to heaven. Yeah, yeah, I know that. My God loves me. It's that easy. My God loves me. My problem is to accept it, you see. I heard from a young guy to me. I learned all my stuff about theology here. I heard from a young guy. I know it's kind of strange, but I heard a young guy say to me one time, if your God's so small that I can understand him, he's not big enough to handle my problems. And that made sense to me because I'm trying to figure out God, see. I'm intelligent, I'm bright, I can do this. I'm trying to comprehend the incomprehensible, you know, the higher power. That shows how stupid you are. You know, you're going to understand the non-understandable or however you say it. And what I found out is the way I understand God is the way God wants to let God known to me. It's mine. That's what I love in the book. When Ebby said to Bill, why don't you choose a God of your own conception? And it made sense, and I started doing that, and I did that, and I did the steps. And so my spirituality for me, when I hear that thing in the book, having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps, and I listen carefully to that sucker. I want to make sure it's there all the time. Having had a spiritual awakening, I need to know what spirituality is, and I need to know how to have it. If I work the steps, I'm going to have one. I also know from the book that spirituality and awakening experience are used interchangeably lots of times in the book. I've never had one of those things. Wow, what's that? No, like Bill did. No, I never had that. What I've had is the slow educational variety that comes around, that my concept of my God is given to me on a daily basis. And it changes a lot, but it's always becoming more loving and more caring and forgiving, and it's always helping me to accept me and to find out who I am and to know what it's about, to be of love and service. And so I've done that thing, and now it's coming back to me. So my spirituality versus... See, religion for me is the way I express my spirituality. That's the way I do. But on page 28 in the book, this took me a long time to find this. It says, if what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, we're all children of a living creator, regardless of race, creed, color, and I always throw in there sex, too, because there was 100 guys made that up. Regardless of race, creed, color, sex, upon simple and may form a relationship. That's what it is. It's not a belief system. It's not a belief system. The belief is given to me in the second step. God just... I don't believe in God because I figured it out. I believe it to it because he gave it to me. The same as he gave me the power to say I'm powerless, then he gives me the belief, and so I believe. And, you know, and I don't have to be very smart. If I'm powerless and I'm going down for the third time, and God says, I'll help, and I believe it, I don't have to be real brilliant to say, here, you know, give me the... You got it. And so I can do that, and it goes around. So my spirituality is my relationship, mine. Not my mother's God, not my father's, not my aunt's, not my uncle's, not the minister, not the priest, not the church. It's my God, as my God makes God known to me. If I want to know who Dan is, I don't ask you, I ask him. If I want to know who God is, I ask God. And I believe he'll tell me. And that's what I had to do. That's what I had to do. You let me know who you want me to think you are. And then I went on with the steps as best I knew how. My sponsor worked with me. I had the worst sponsor in the world. He never had an intelligent thought. He never, ever understood my problems. I would go over to him and explain my problem, because I had very unique problems that were very different than all of yours, and I would tell him, and he'd just laugh at me. Then he'd say, why don't you read the book and go to a meeting? And geez, I just knew he didn't know much about the program. And then he'd talk about himself and tell me what he did. But I loved Ed. I loved him with a passion. I'll never forget. I'll never forget I had the privilege to bury him. And it was like a great big AA meeting, and it was just great. And God knew how bad I needed it. The way I met Ed was he came up to me one time and said, when I was still in the hospital, and he said, see that book on the table there? I said hi to him, talked to him. He was leaving. He said, see that book on the table there? And I said, oh, yes, yes. I thought I'd teach him a little lesson. He had the cover on it. That's the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I know. It saved my life for the last 23 and a half years. And I said, my God, there's one in the parish. My parish is half full of them now. I mean, geez, half the parish is alcoholic. I mean, it's a great place to, you know, it's a great place. I mean, but, so anyhow, I went on. I did my fourth and fifth. I really did my fourth and fifth in a kind of an unconventional fashion. I did it with a group. I was in a therapy group. And except the only thing is my therapist was a little gal about this tall. I loved her with a passion. Her name was Edie. She had a mouth on her make a salty sailor sound like a panty waist. That's when she was cleaning it up for me. I mean, kind of when she would come in and she'd say, my name's Edie and I love the alcoholic and I hate the disease of alcoholism. And you knew she meant it. And God, I need to hear that early on. Well, I did my what we call the first step there. I did my fifth step with them. God, I hope they stay sober. But I did all this, and I kind of unloaded it, and God gave me the grace and the ability to be able to do that and get it off my chest. And I remember saying in the middle of it, I was telling this stuff, and I was talking about what I did and what it was like, and I remember all of a sudden I started to cry like a baby because it came clear as a bell to me right in the middle of my first step that my major character defect was that I had never said thank you. I just cried out. I remember I said, oh, my God, I'm so ungrateful. So ungrateful. I never said thank you. I forgot to say thank you for all you've done for me. Well, I went on. I only got a couple minutes. Six and seven, I want to share something with you, and don't get mad at me now, because I'm going to do my inventory, all right? My inventory. When I got sober, I was smoking about 3.5 packs of cigarettes a day, all right? And it was my character. My throat was hurting. I was getting headaches. And my voice is important to me. And I was getting sore throats. And it tasted like burnt paper. And I couldn't stop it. You know, I was really hooked and all that kind of stuff. And so I decided on the day before I went for a year and a day. The 5th of March in 1981. I was laying in bed one morning. I remember this as clear as a bell. I was laying there. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder what I ought to do for Lent. The priest ought to do something for Lent. You're telling everybody else to do something for Lent. Why don't you do something for Lent? I wonder what I ought to do. And a big neon sign flashed on the ceiling. It said, quit smoking. Ah, come on. You know, and I rationalized I was going to quit. I always used to say I was going to quit at the end of this carton, and I'd always run out right in front of Save Mart or something like that, you know. And I rationalized and rationalized and rationalized, and finally I just said, I can't. It's the first time I said. I used to always say I don't want it yet, or I'm under too much pressure. I come up with all these things. And this time I'm sober. This is the trouble with it. I was sober 14 months. And finally I said, I just can't. I just can't. If I'm going to do it, you're going to have to do it for me. Now, I don't hear voices, but what I got back was, I thought you'd never ask. You know, and then I said, well, how? Work your program one day at a time. And I'll never forget that. And what I have discovered about six and seven, let me tell you something that really helped me, has been a tremendous help to me. I have to remember it every single day. We're all perfectionists. I just think that's a riot. We're perfectionists. You know, I throw up, fall down, wet my pants. I'm a real perfectionist. You know what I mean? But we really are. That's why we drink and use, because we're perfectionists. And so I remember that first night, that first meeting I went to, I remember them reading the 12 steps. And I remember just before that, half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked for protection and care with complete abandon. I'm saying, oh, my God. These are the steps we took. And they read the steps, and I said, I'm screwed. I can't do this. And then I heard it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us can maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. This thing is about growth. It's not about achieving a goal of perfection. It's about growing. We're looking for spiritual growth, not perfection. And so what I've discovered is the six and the steps are kind of like goals for me that I grow toward. I don't I don't take the test and get 100 and say, okay, that one's done, now I'll go on to the next one. I'm doing what I can do. I'm growing in these steps. So when I hear that sixth step became entirely ready to have God remove and to take them away, I can't remember exactly how it says it, but entirely ready to have God remove them all, I think that's what it is. Became entire. I think the degree to which I'm willing and the degree to which I'm ready to have him taken away and to take them all away, to that degree, take them away. I don't think, okay, I'm all ready, now here they go, boom, and I'm done. No. But I think that as ready as I can get and as willing as I am to let him do it, he does it. See, for the first 14 months, what I heard was, became entirely ready to have God help me. And then humbly asked God to help me overcome them, and nothing happened. And I didn't understand. He isn't helping me. He's doing it. And then humbly go to him. And for me, that word humbly, I know all kinds of people have all kinds of definitions of it. That's none of my business. For me, what's my business is what humbly means to me. It's for me to accept myself for who I really am. I'll never forget when I came to these meetings and you said, I'm a liar, thief, and cheat. And I said, God, don't talk about it. You know, I just didn't want to accept it or own it. Today I can say it. I remember also Johnny Harris saying one time, if you don't want to lie, don't lie. And I just hate him for that, you know. But it was that idea to humbly ask God to take them away. And I think the degree to which I own those character defects as my own, that this is who I am a liar, and I don't want to lie anymore, and to ask him to take that away, the degree to which I'm willing to let him take it away. When I hear people say, well, I guess God mustn't be willing because I'm still lying, I say, bullshit, you know. Don't blame God, blame me. The problem is me, not my higher power. The problem is me. When I'm ready to let go, it'll get taken away. And I have to remind myself of that all the time. 10 is a hard one for me. I just don't like 10 at all. I don't like any of the steps. They go against my nature. 100%. But I hurt so bad that I got to do them. The word I don't like in the 10th step is continue to take personal inventory and when we're wrong. I don't even like to say that word in practice. The night they did that intervention, I remember turning around to him and I'm saying, you know, what am I going to do? And I said, well, you know, tell him you'll quit for a year. And I remember turning around and saying to him, gosh, guys, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for what I did. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to quit for a year. And they just sat there and looked at me and I said, don't you believe me? And they said, no. No. But you know what I was saying to them? That I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I never once said I was wrong. Never once. Today, that's what I have to do. That's the ego buster that I hate about it. I just detest it. And the only reason why I work the 10th step is it hurts too bad not to. It just hurts too bad. If I do something wrong, you know, and I know all right. I just want to say to them, all right. 11 was a big relief for me because you can't have any idea if you're a priest how what a relief 11 is, because I used to have to pray that Aunt Lulabelle would get better and George would get the job and it wouldn't rain on this side of that. And God, I was trying to run the whole life and keep it all in. It was like having four balls in and somebody throws the six, you know, in. And I don't have to do that anymore. It's a tremendous relief. All I have to do is ask God's will to be done. Just let me know your will. And the other thing, I think we forget the second half of 11, because in the second half of 11, I say a lot of times, and I'm sure you do too, slip into it at times, you know, if I only knew God's will, I'd be so happy to do it. If I only knew his will, I'd be so happy to... That's a crock. I don't want to do his will. I want to do mine. My will. Mine. Not God's will. So I have to pray for the power. That's what I said in the first step. I'm powerless. So now when I get to 11, I realize what it is I have to ask for the power to do what he wants for me to do. So not only to know it, but the power to do it. And I have a relationship with my God today. It's just beautiful. Just beautiful. And I know what it's all about. The book told me. It's not about being good. God being good to drag. But what it's about is love and service. That's what my primary purpose in life is, to be of service to God and to my brothers and sisters in AA and to love them. Love God and love them. And that's what it's all about for me. That's what my life's supposed to be about. And that's what I'm here for, and that's why I work these steps. When I was 6 months sober, I bought a tape and I heard a guy by the name of Ray O'Keefe. He was a boy wonder judge from Fordham University and was appointed to the bench, and he went out and got blitzed and lost his judgeship and lost his professorship and lost everything, and he was a real mess, and then he was brought back around again, and he made it. And I got to hear Ray's tape. And I sat down here, and you have a meeting here, evidently, that you use at a member's eye view, the pamphlet. I think it might be a Sunday night meeting or something. A member's eye view. And in the end of that thing, I just love it. The old one used to have an eye on it, and you could see it from a mile away, you know. But anyhow, on the back end of that one, there's a little story in there, and Ray told the story, and I always, it just fits me so much. He said when Jesus was around and John the Baptist got thrown in jail, and he sent his boys over. He said, go ask. John sent his boys and said, go ask him if he's the one, or should we look for somebody else? And he sent him back a message, and he said, go tell John that the blind see, the deaf hear, the lame walk, the poor in spirit have good news, preach to them, and the dead rise to life. Well, before the 21st of January in 1980, I was absolutely blind. I couldn't see anything except what I wanted to see. And I was really sick. I had little sores above my head that wouldn't heal. My esophagus was going bad. My gut was killing me. And I was just a mess. And I honestly thought I'd have been better off dead. I used to really think that if I was just dead, it'd be all over and wouldn't have to worry about it. And they all say that the poor in spirit are the people who don't have any hope and don't have hardly anything. And that they have the good news. And the good news is that there is a life and there is something, and the good news is around. Well, on the 21st of January, by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got the good news. And now I can see, and I can hear, and I know just what Lazarus felt like when Jesus said, come on, get out of there and get back here. Because that's exactly what it was like for me. It was a whole new world and a whole, just wonderful, and I just love it. And I love AA with all my heart and soul. I love it like a passion. And for those of you who are new, I beg of you, please don't go out and drink. And I'm very selfish about this. I don't care about you, but I want you here because I need you. You see, my greatest need is that you need me, and your greatest need is for me to need you. And I love you all very, very much. And the reason why I know that, you can say, well, you can't love me. You don't know who I am. I remember Dr. Paul say one time, and I think it's true, love is an act of the will. And I choose to love you. Because without you, I'd be a helpless, hopeless drunk. And because of you, the grace of God, and the fellowship of AA, I'm alive today, and I have a lot of good news. And I'm so happy to be here, and I hope I never forget to say thank you. Thank you for letting me share it.